All right, good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by KARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. My name is Jeff. My co-presenter is Marianne. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, listeners. Wake up, but stay in bed because it's cold outside. I'm telling you now.
Yeah, top of 19, Marianne.
Yeah, I was 13, I think, when I came in to the studio. It was not warm at all.
Yeah, it's like the first taste of autumn, isn't it?
Glimpse. Well, yeah, what happened to summer?
Yeah.
Well, we had our 4 days of summer, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, we did. All right, for those who aren't aware of KARMA, KARMA is a peer-based community-controlled drug organisation, drug user organisation. Now, the development of the needle and syringe program, expansion of opioid maintenance treatment, and the funding of drug use organisations began as part of the highly successful public health response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Australia back in the 1980s, which we've discussed many times, Marianne.
We have.
By involving affected communities, Australia was able to keep HIV infection rates very low by global standards. Another virus that does affect injecting drug users, hepatitis C, now has new treatments known as direct-acting antivirals, or DAAs, that can cure people with hepatitis C, which is truly an incredible breakthrough.
It is indeed. Well, can I just say, Jeffrey, sure. I'd really like to do a shout-out to... KARMA is actually about the second or third incarnation of the ACTIV League, and that was initially established through a larger non-government organisation, but as a standalone organisation, and it was Jude, our dear Jude Boone, who is not well at the moment. And so I just would like to send out a loving shout out to her this yes. morning and say, get yourself better, old bat, because I want to see you back and doing your bit.
Yeah, well
so
said, Mary.
Look after yourself, my darling, because yeah. we need you.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would... echo and endorse that.
I have had a lot of calls from people saying, Jude's not well, can we send our love to her through you? And I say, of course you can.
Yeah, well said, Marion. Okay, sadly, as the policies of prohibition remain largely unchanged, it's been a battle.
That's
but
why we're still on the radio, gang. Funny that.
Still battling away, tilting at windmills.
Yeah. I love that expression.
Sadly, as the policies of prohibition remain largely unchanged, human rights abuses and the stigmatising and discrimination of people who use drugs continues to take place. And we'd like to acknowledge the efforts of peers and activists who have contributed to the fight against prohibition and also to reaffirm our commitment to continue the fight against the harms caused by prohibition in all of its manifestations. And the show also aims to educate and inform listeners about the failure of prohibition, also known as the war on people who use drugs, and we also promote the services offered by KARMA and also other agencies and organisations in the ACT.
Which I will do right now, just before we go to our first song. The Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy is Canberra's only peer-based drug user group. KARMA provides a wide range of services such as client advocacy, peer treatment support, education information, creative arts, mentoring and referrals, and this loud and noisy radio show. The office is located at Churches Centre and Shop 17, Level 1, 54 Benjamin Way in Belconnen. The office hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday to Friday. And the KARMA phone number is 6253 3643. KARMA continues to run its Australian first opioid overdose recognition response with naloxone workshops and also does brief interventions with individual clients. That's brief interventions using naloxone with individual clients. It can help people with a wide range of issues, including opioid maintenance treatment, that's methadone, buprenorphine, or more recently the new long-lasting injectable form like Buvidal and Sublocade, which I hadn't heard of. The availability of detox and rehab services in the ACT or around the ACT, the negative impact of stigma and discrimination, difficulties with getting access to proper pain relief, all issues faced by people adversely impacted by prohibition and the war on people who use drugs.
And they are too numerous to list. And
absolutely. So we won't bother, but most people who listen to the show will know because we've said them week after week. And we're doing actually an interesting story, a couple of stories later on about the changes that are happening in, particularly in Oregon.
Yes.
And that's more up to date than what's happened in Portugal, which people are not really thrilled about. The users in particular are not thrilled about, although the community at large seems to think it's worked well, but they're happy about it. And that's, I think, what you need is for the population to be pleased with the change in, with the reforms and not see them as a threat to the community at large.
Yeah.
But the user, from the user's perspective, it hasn't been quite as successful as they wanted it to be.
Well, not quite as rosy as some of the
and some of the journalists have painted it. And the medical, I mean, people don't ask users generally what's happened, how did it affect you, is it good for you? I mean, who asks anybody else, is that good for you? Nobody, really. Ask Brittany.
Good point. Okay, the contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast and podcast does not necessarily reflect the views and or policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. KHARMA does not condone nor condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. KHARMA recognises that drug use happens, and as such, KHARMA focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. KHARMA seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred holistic health care and equity of health service delivery for all people.
Indeed. The next date for the KHARMA Opioid Overdose Recognition Response Workshop is actually today. It's at the Early Morning Centre. And really, if you want to book a place, please call the Early Morning Centre on 6247 5041. That's 6247 5041. And that's this afternoon from 2 to 3:30 p.m. So ring this morning if you want to get a place in that workshop. You get paid to do the workshop and you also come out with the capacity to save a life. Now, I don't care what they said on the CSI workshop. Naloxone only reverses opioid overdose. Mm-hmm. There was a TV program on the other night, Jeffrey, that said that it was used for something else.
Oh,
right?
Really? Oh, they got it wrong?
It was just ludicrous. But it was just a matter of continuity. They just hadn't done their research properly.
Yeah.
The point is, if you know how to use naloxone, you know how to save somebody's life from an opioid overdose. So learn how to do that. Get paid to do it. Walk out with a nasal spray on that you can shove up someone's nose and bring them back from the overdose of opioids that they have just taken. And even if they haven't taken opioid overdose and it doesn't make them recover, at least you know. And it's not going to hurt them to have that stuff up their nose anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, learn how to save someone's life from opioid.
Yeah, okay? And it's great that the Early Morning Centre hosts KHARMA to do the training.
And it's very sensible. It's local, it's central to Canberra, it's right on Northbourne Avenue, and you know they don't have huge numbers in the groups as they run them. They're really user-friendly. You go in, you can ask any questions you want to, learn whatever you want to learn. Know from point one how to deal with opioid overdose. And all the physical and psychological factors involved in that. You learn what you need to know. So, 6247 5041.
Indeed. I don't know if you're aware of this, Marion, but the classic Don McLean song, American Pie, is 50 years old.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, American Pie. No, I didn't until you told me, Jeffrey, but I think it's great. So are we going to hear it?
I think we should play it.
I think it's only appropriate,
I think it's fair. I remember hearing it as a youngster, and I think it stands up really well today. So here's Don McLean with American Pie. What a classic. That was
all of it. All of American Pie by Don McLean. That was fabulous, Jeffrey. 50th birthday.
50th birthday. I'm glad it's radio, Marion, because you and I were singing along like
that's right.
A couple of old
good,
couple
we can
school
turn
kids.
The microphones down so we don't have to be heard to be singing along to it.
But, yeah, what a classic and what brilliant lyrics. I mean, it's so open to interpretation, isn't it, even to this day. And
that's right. But, I mean, if you were around at the time, you could tell pretty well what it was about.
Yeah.
Even though he said, Don McLean came out and said, no, you take what you want.
Yeah.
You interpret it the way you want to. Well, that saved him getting sued, didn't it? I suspect.
Stands up well today.
It does.
All right, it's coming up about 11 minutes to 11 o'clock. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marion.
On Public Radio 2XX.
98.3
FM,
Go to an important story written by the first medical director of the Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in King's Cross.
Cross,
in response to some of the calls which we reported on last week, about wanting to remove the facility to bring back the life in King's Cross.
Yes.
Blame MSIC, yeah.
Yes, but there's no reason to blame the injecting centre, as this article goes on to say. Jeffrey, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'll kick it off. It's entitled "Alcohol, Not the Injecting Room, Is the Real Worry for the Revival of King's Cross."
That was the reason it closed down. That was why the early closing laws came in.
Yeah? Was from people being...
It was because the so-called one punch.
Yeah, king hit, people killed.
Kids being knocked over and dying on the streets of King's Cross. It was not about the safe injecting centre. It was about alcohol consumption.
No, it's trying to find an scapegoat. Yeah. Okay, this was published in the Sydney Morning Herald, February the 14th. Alas, the Daily Telegraph's reporters lying in wait for weeks in a hotel room directly opposite. Their cameras trained on our entrance, they missed the scoop. The flickering light of the TV emanating from behind the closed curtains suggested that they may have been distracted by that night's State of Origin match. Queensland won again. And so, unannounced 20 years ago this year, the medically supervised injecting centre in King's Cross opened, becoming the first supervised injecting facility in the English-speaking world. At the time, it seemed like that opening day on May the 6th just might never arrive. From the moment it was recommended by the Carr government's drug summit 2 years before, the centre's establishment was mired in controversy. The Vatican intervened to stop the Sisters of Charity from operating the centre.
Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that.
It's incredible.
That's amazing.
So the Uniting Church stepped in. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime and the International Narcotics Control Board warned Australia off. And then Prime Minister John Howard was explicitly opposed, along with his chief advisor.
So-called Salvation Army. He wasn't even allowed to wear his uniform
at that stage,
but he did. Brian Waters, yeah. Well, so-called Major Brian Waters.
He was the major advisor on drug policy to the Prime Minister. Failed Supreme Court proceedings initiated by the now defunct King's Cross Chamber of Commerce and Tourism further delayed the opening. And though the Telegraph missed its first moments, within an hour, all five TV stations were out front. Thankfully, such intense media scrutiny settled over the ensuing years and we were able to get on with the serious business of providing a life-saving health service for the most marginalised of drug users already dwelling in that area. During this time, almost 18,000 drug users attended and some 1.2 million drug injecting episodes occurred in this clinical environment.
Yeah, so much for nothing. We don't have any injectors in Australia, yeah? No,
well,
no drug users here.
Sort of makes a lie of that, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So that all took place in a clinical environment instead of on the streets of King's Cross.
Yeah.
10,541 overdoses were successfully treated without a single fatality, dramatically reducing ambulance call-outs to the area, and about 18,500 referrals made to drug rehab and other services. Repeated random telephone surveys undertaken as part of the centre's independent evaluation showed high levels of local community support, the most recent finding that 78% of residents and 70% of businesses supported the centre's operation at its current location on what's colloquially known as the Strip. The only complaint is that it can be easily missed, the entrance being so innocuous.
Who would have thought that would be a complaint at all? So you can perhaps understand my dismay. This is Ingrid van Beek speaking. My dismay at this week's Herald headline, inverted commas, King's Cross businesses want removal of injecting centre to revive Strip. In the article, the King's Cross Liquor Records coordinator, Doug Grand, spooked the notion that if the centre was removed, the drug users in the area would somehow miraculously disappear, boosting the area's recovery from the lockout laws that will be axed next month. The reality is that those thousands of injecting episodes that have been occurring there would simply return to the local environments. That's the back streets she's talking about, which would surely be counterproductive to the Accord's push to enhance the area's attractiveness to its prospective bar customers. It should be recognised that not only has the centre saved many lives and improve the prospects of those often deemed to be beyond hope by moving drug injecting off the streets, it has actually enabled the area's gentrification over these past 20 years. While not seeking credit for this, the centre certainly takes exception to the implication that its presence impedes this. Grant says of drug users, quote, some of them get abusive, some of them get aggressive, end quote. He needs to speak to his members about just how abusive and aggressive their alcohol-affected clientele can be. Has he forgotten why the lockout laws were introduced in the first place? King's Cross has become a nightmarish on week had become nightmarish on weekend nights, with hundreds of drunken revellers spilling out onto the street. Plastic glasses required to reduce the glassings, which had become common. Glad to see this requirement is remaining in place. The hospital emergency and police data for violent incidents, including the tragic deaths of two young men, told the story. Just two young men, and they were from being knocked on the back of the head and hitting their heads on the concrete. And that was alcohol-induced, I might add. Anyway, the hospital emergency and police data for violent incidents, including the tragic deaths of two young men, told the story. Rather than opportunistically focusing on the medically supervised injecting centre, the King's Cross Liquor Accord should look to itself, should be looking to itself to make sure that this shocking scenario, all of which developed on its watch, doesn't recur. I'm at least heartened that our Premier has always been supportive of the centre. At the very beginning of her first term in office in 2003, Gladys Berejiklian came to the centre to be briefed about its work. Along with several, and she's very anti-drugs, as we know.
As a rule, yeah.
Mm. Along with several other LNP opposition MPs, she repeatedly voted with the New South Wales government in favour of the centre's continuation until its trial status was finally lifted in 2010. We hope that others will also base their opinions on the mountain of evidence available, showing that it is a quiet achiever, doing a hard job well, now and into the future. Dr. Ingrid van Beek was the founding medical director of the medically supervised injecting centre from 2000 to 2008. And she did a really good job getting that off the ground and getting it going. Was no mean feat. And Ingrid actually made a very good front front of house person to actually present to the media a focus. She's a doctor, a medical doctor. She was an emergency doctor. She knew what she was talking about. And she presented very well.
Yep.
And kept that centre going throughout its trial period, minus 2 years, obviously.
Well, but wasn't the trial 10 years?
Yes, 2010 it finished.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
it took a long time.
So it's been going another 10 years since the trial then. And not been defunded. And now under Gladys Berejiklian, that's surprising because, as we know, she's been anti-pill testing.
Yep.
But nonetheless, it has made a huge difference to King's Cross. And where people do their injecting has made safe injecting a practice, a common practice, not an anomaly.
Yep.
And that's what we want to see. We don't want to see people with infections or dying in back streets or creating any kind of furor out on the streets. The King's Cross was always the centre of drinking and drugging and sexing for Sydney. Yeah,
yes.
That was where...
Going back a long time.
From 1960s, when the American R&R... The soldiers were coming in on R&R. That's when it started really taking off. And even before that, William Street was still a hive of activity for young people and rock and rollers. So sex, drugs and rock and roll has always been part of Sydney, and that was one of the reasons why it was so popular. I mean, let's...
Absolutely.
Good heavens, Robin Askin would have been really proud to call it home. In fact, he was.
It was the life and the heart
Absolutely.
And soul.
Absolutely, yeah. That was what it was all about. Sydney was about having fun, right, which included drinking, drugging and sexing.
Yeah, yeah. But no, she did a heroic performance in establishing
it. And had it not been for the performance of the injecting centre, safe injecting centre in Sydney, there certainly wouldn't have been one in Victoria.
That's true.
There is now, love to see if that, the response to that has been much the same. I bet it has.
Mm. Oh, look, it's always easy to cast aspersions.
But you just have to look at where that guy's coming from, who's casting, casting.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What, stones in the water, really.
What's their vested interest? What are they?
The alcohol lobby, what would you think?
Well, it's funny, when there was the lockout laws being proposed, the alcohol industry was basically saying, look, it's not us, it's ecstasy, it's all this other stuff, other drugs.
What a load of crap.
Yeah, I think it was very disingenuous. And if they're so concerned about health and safety, well, have a look at introducing some harm reduction measures in your industry.
Talk about it at least.
Yeah.
They won't even acknowledge that it is an issue.
I mean,
How can you not? It's a drug. It's a very intense drug. Oh, yes, we've got
The news at 11 coming up.
Thinking about newsing?
Just about 30 seconds away. Well done to Ingrid. Great piece. You're going to go and have a smoke?
Yep. I might do that.
Sounds sure. good.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Just dog me in, why don't you? You're a shocker sometimes. All right, listen to the news, you guys. You've got 20 seconds.
Enjoy yourself.
Thanks, sweetheart.
All right, this is News from the Drug War Front on 2XX Community Radio, and it is now time for the news.
Week after a second shipment arrived in Sydney. The first doses were administered on Sunday to Prime Minister Scott Morrison and quarantine and healthcare workers. Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says 50,000 of the new jabs will be made available to the states and 30,000 to the aged care sector. He says the federal government is being cautious with the rollout of the vaccine to avoid issues with supply.
It's important that we have consistency. We're always provisioning for the second doses, which is the recommendation of our medical advisers, and making sure that we have contingency if at any stage there were an issue with the supply chain.
JobSeeker could yet be saved in some form, with the federal government set to consider extending the coronavirus supplement at a party room meeting today. The coronavirus supplement was added to JobSeeker last year and is set to expire at the end of the month, with payments to go back to pre-pandemic levels of $40 a day. The government is believed to be considering either a permanent rise to the payment or continuing with the supplement. Shadow Government Services Minister Bill Shorten told Channel 9 the payment should not be reduced any further.
$40 a day is too low. I don't think anyone can live on that, and so therefore an increase is overdue and will be welcome, but let's check the detail.
The United States has crossed the staggering milestone of 500,000 COVID-19 deaths just over a year since the coronavirus pandemic claimed its first known victim in California. The country has recorded more than 28 million infections, although daily cases and hospitalizations have fallen to their lowest level since before the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. Nearly one in every five coronavirus deaths around the world have occurred in the US. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will attend a candle lighting ceremony and hold a moment of silence to mark the grim statistic. NASA has unveiled a first-of-its-kind video captured by the Mars Perseverance rover as it touched down on the Red Planet. The minute-long footage is of the rover recording itself while landing on the planet last week. It shows the rover getting slowly closer to landing after the parachute was deployed and dust on the surface being rapidly disturbed before the module finally touches down. NASA also released audio of the first sounds ever recorded on the surface of Mars, a gust of wind captured by a microphone on the rover. The sound of wind on Mars, courtesy of NASA. Police in Western New South Wales have seized nearly 50 kilograms of magic mushrooms in Western Sydney. They say the drugs had a potential street value of nearly $750,000. The drugs were seized in a series of raids, which also netted cocaine, knives and cash. A 26-year-old man has been charged with drug manufacture and supply offences. He was refused bail and will face court today. Turning to sport, and Carlton AFLW player Madison Presparkis has been hit with a one-match ban for a dangerous tackle in last weekend's win over Richmond. The incident occurred in the second quarter and was classed as careless conduct, medium impact and high contact. Carlton has been given until later this morning to decide if it will challenge the decision. If the suspension is upheld, Presparkis will miss the Blues round 5 match against North Melbourne and will be ineligible to win a second consecutive league best and fairest award.
National Radio News is supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation, cbf.org.au.
All right, welcome back to News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. And just while I've got a minute, I'd like to encourage any listeners who listen and like our show or any of the other many original shows that are produced by volunteers each and every week here on Canberra's Community Radio to seriously consider becoming a financial supporter of 2XX. Community Radio runs on the smell of an oily rag, and the enthusiasm and hard work of countless volunteers, including Marion and myself. So if you can, become a financial supporter of 2XX.
Okay, Marion, I thought
we'd do this story. It's from the UK and we mentioned it last week, but you, as you said rightly, many people actually are prescribed or are on antidepressants. And, of course, they interact with recreational drugs.
They do.
And this piece from Vice.com by Kat Smith basically is entitled What Happens When You Mix Antidepressants and Recreational Drugs.
Yeah, that's really good and informative piece, and I'm glad we're doing it, Geoffrey.
Yeah, I think it offers some very helpful information.
Yeah.
And its subheading is taking recreational drugs when you're on a course of antidepressants can cause comedowns, anxiety and even muscle spasms. Just under 1 in 6 of England's adult population are on antidepressants, while 1 in 10 admit to using illicit drugs.
I wonder if that's changed since COVID.
I would say...
I wonder if the data has. I mean, this is from February the 9th, this article, but nonetheless, I wondered when the data was from, because a lot of people suffered during lockdowns.
I think all drug consumption would have been going up. I
mean, absolutely. Well, many articles have been saying that, haven't
they? Yeah, indeed. This crossover poses a few potential problems. When combined, antidepressants and recreational drugs come with their own set of side effects and risks. But even though there are strong links between drug use, dependence and depression, there is surprisingly little information out there about what happens to your body when you mix these drugs. So we spoke to some experts to gain a better understanding.
So cannabis is the first one that they have investigated. The impact of mixing cannabis and antidepressants can depend on the different types of both drugs, says James Giordano, a professor of neurology and biochemistry at Georgetown University Medical Center in Washington, D.C. If the cannabis has a slightly higher THC value, you're going to get more of the arousal effect, the euphoria effect, and, in some cases, anxiety, he says. Tom, 25, was on antidepressants from the age of 16 to 22 and used to smoke weed daily. He's quoted as saying, "When I smoked on antidepressants, sometimes I'd get so anxious," he says. "If I smoke now, when I'm not on them, I can usually shrug off my anxiety." Any cannabis come down may also be extended by taking antidepressants, says Giordano. Quote, "As the cannabis begins to wear off, people can get a bit of a rebound agitation, and it can make some individuals feel unresponsive or emotionally flat. The effect that the antidepressant drug has is that it extends this come down a bit longer." Giordano's main concern is mixing high THC cannabis products with a type of antidepressant called monoamine oxidase inhibitors, so MAOIs. They have lots of side effects, I might add, and people have been generally loath to prescribe them, unless people are young and don't have much in the way of physical illness. Quote, "With cannabis products that are higher in THC, you might start to see some cardiovascular effects. This is because MAOIs can increase the availability of norepinephrine in our system, which can lead to altered cardiovascular responses." So norepinephrine is like an adrenaline-type drug, yeah? But it's a naturally occurring... Anyway, it can lead to altered cardiovascular responses such as changes in blood pressure, heart rate and rhythm.
Yeah, the next drug they discuss is MDMA. MDMA is known for its euphoric effect, or high. But when 22-year-old Dora started taking it while on a course of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, another genre of antidepressants, she barely felt a thing. Quote, "I would look around and I felt like everyone else was just having a much better time than me," she says. "I was at 10% and everyone else was at 100%. This reaction, or lack thereof, is not uncommon for people on a stable dose of antidepressants, says Adam Winstock, an addiction medicine specialist and the founder of the Global Drug Survey, which has been going for a number of years and is, you know, a chance for people to do it around the world and talk about their drug use. Quote, "People are on antidepressants and have been for some while will report blunted emotional responses with MDMA. That's due to competition at the transporter site. MDMA causes a greater release of serotonin, which provides that sense of euphoria. But SSRIs regulate serotonin levels, preventing them from not only dropping off, but from surging too."
And that's something that you have to expect with with things like SSRIs and MAOIs is that if serotonin is the active ingredient or active operator in the system, and these drugs are reducing the uptake or the effect of that, and it's not going to happen. And that's one of the reasons people take drugs, recreational drugs, is because it does or it doesn't do that for them. So they use them for that effect. But if you're already getting that, you need to, from your antidepressant, then the reason that you are using the drugs will be taken away. So you need to keep that well and truly in mind. Sorry, Jeffrey, that you haven't finished your bit.
But be aware of the potential.
That's right. So don't take twice the amount, because you're really just not going to get... It's not going to happen for you. And I think it's good that we're doing this, because people need to know this kind of stuff, and otherwise they wouldn't be looking into it.
It's really important information.
It is important information. The problem is that whenever recreational drug users have been given information, it has been information rather than helpful.
Here's
stuff
how to
like
do it
this.
Safely. By taking more MDMA to try to reach that high, Winstock says that those on SSRIs not only risk the same adverse effects of MDMA as others, they also risk suffering from serotonin syndrome. This is where too much serotonin floods into your system. Symptoms can include irritability, muscle rigidity and spasms, confusion and nausea, and if left untreated, it can even become fatal.
Yeah.
Winstock says, therefore, that the advice for people who are on stable doses of antidepressants has to be... Please don't take any.
Cocaine. Okay, taking cocaine, which is another stimulant, while on antidepressants also puts you at risk of too much serotonin flooding your body. Winstock warns that cocaine can severely undermine the effects of antidepressants. I always think that antidepressants are like putting a plug in the sink, because you're trying to fill your brain up with good chemicals, he says. And what coke does is pull the plug out. While you may still get that short-term euphoria, the come-down will be dreadful. This is what happened with Ben, 21, who took coke during a particularly low part of lockdown. I remember a heightened sense of anxiety while I was coming down, he says, but I think this partly came from me worrying that by mixing coke, the antidepressant, fluoxetine, and alcohol, I'd really fucked up. Alcohol. When Emily, 22, this is the big one, and I think we need to take particular account of this. When Emily, 22, was first prescribed antidepressants at 16, she continued her weekend ritual of binge drinking at parties. Over time, she realised it wasn't good for her. Quote, alcohol used to lead to an increased suicidal thoughts for me, she says. All my suicide attempts were usually after I'd been drinking or while I was still drunk. Many people suffering from depressions are also likely to drink, but, quote, alcohol will stop a lot of antidepressants working, says Winstock. He says this is because alcohol alters the ability of the antidepressant to change your chemical imbalance and can exacerbate your mood. So if you're already depressed or anxious, you could feel worse. The only thing I have to say about this is I think that most drugs we take actually enhance how we're already feeling. Some things really, I mean, we don't take drugs in order to feel a particular way. We take a drug in order that it enhances what we are already feeling. So if you're already frightened, you do get paranoid. Mm. If you're already anxious, you do start to get palpitations. If you're already nervous, you do start to feel like you don't want to go anywhere and a little bit paranoid. I think we need to take that into account too. People take their drugs for where they want to get to. So, yeah, different drugs and doses will react in different ways to varying types of antidepressants. And, of course, everyone has a unique physical response to drugs and drug mixtures. Quote, we treat so many people who have dual diagnosis, a horrible term I might add, which means psych-affected and drug-affected at the same time, and you tell me who isn't, where they have a drug and mental health problem, and I put that in inverted commas, says Nuno Albuquerque, treatment lead at UK Addiction Treatment, UCAT. How a person reacts to drugs always differs depending on both their physical and psychological situation at the time of use. If you're taking antidepressants and you want the best possible outcome, Winstock advises that taking your medication every day and avoiding things that could reduce its effectiveness, such as recreational drugs, People should never stop taking their antidepressants suddenly in order to take recreational drugs. He says no one should ever, especially SSRIs and MAOIs, because you can have very bad reactions from that. I noticed they didn't include opioids in that, Jeffrey, and I don't, I'm at a loss to understand why, because opioids can be used as a recreational drug as much as anything else, but I have found over the years, my perception, this is not from the article, my perception is people take opioids in order to get that flattened effect, right, so to even out their emotional response, if you like, to the world, and because they are either in chronic psychological or physical pain, and it settles that for them.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why they didn't include opioids in it, is because often people will take opioids and will not be prescribed antidepressants while they're still taking those opioids. While they go on to methadone, they will be.
How widespread is antidepressant prescribing? Do you know?
I think when people go on to methadone or go on to an opioid replacement therapy, we find that it tends to be increased a bit.
Yeah, okay.
That's the reporting of it. Jeffrey, I can't say for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert. I'm not a researcher in this. This is the big A anecdotal. But I think that people often find that they are really quite depressed or quite distressed and can be diagnosed as depressed because of that distressed state that they are in, and that's why they use opioids. That also, although it doesn't cure you of pain, it gets rid of the pain. Or you don't care about it. Mm-hmm. Right? The pain might still be there, but it doesn't matter so much, yeah? That's what opioids do for me and mine. So I think that, and I have heard of quite a number of people who have had antidepressants prescribed for them when they have become stabilised on their opioid substitution therapy.
Okay. All right, we'll go to a song. This is The Doors and Touch Me, The Doors. All right, that was The Doors and Touch Me. It's coming up about 20 minutes after 11. You're listening to news from the drug war front on People Powered Radio, 2XXFM 98.3, and you're with Jeff and Maren in the studio. Got a very positive story here. People know, regular listeners to the show will know that the American state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest had a citizen-initiated referendum at the November elections, which basically has decriminalized the personal possession of virtually, well, all drugs, really.
Mm.
Now, this piece is by Scott Atkins and Clay Mosser. It's reproduced with permission by the UK magazine now. I think they've just got a web presence, Black Poppy, February the 17th. Some good news to emerge from the United States. Note, this law passed at the end of November 2020, but we thought we should put it up here as it's such a major bit of groundbreaking legislation that who knows what might come next. An American state doing narcotic decriminalisation. Who would have thought? Oregon became the first state in the United States to decriminalise the possession of all drugs on November the 3rd, 2020. Measure 110, or 110, was a ballot initiative funded by the Drug Policy Alliance, a non-profit advocacy group backed in part by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. I didn't know that.
Wow.
And it passed with a vote of more than 58% of the voters of Oregon. Possession of heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine and other drugs for personal use is now no longer a criminal offence in the state of Oregon. That's a major step.
Fabulous.
Those drugs are still against the law as they're selling them, but possession is now a civil, not criminal, violation that may result in a fine or court-ordered therapy, but not jail. Marijuana, which Oregon legalised back in 2014, remains fully legal. Oregon's move is radical to the United States, but several European countries have decriminalised drugs to some extent. There are three main arguments for this major drug policy reform, and the first one is drug prohibition has failed.
Surprise!
As we say week in, week out, Marion.
Don't we?
It's a failure. Back in 1971, then US President Richard Nixon declared drugs to be, quote, public enemy number one, and launched a, quote, war on drugs. That continues to this day. The ostensible rationale for harshly punishing drug users is to deter drug use. But decades of research, including our own, on marijuana and drugs generally, has found the deterrent effect of strict criminal punishment to be small, if it exists at all. This is especially true amongst young people who are the majority of drug users. This is partly due to the nature of drug use and also because there are simply limits to how much punishment can deter crime. As a result, the United States has both the world's highest incarceration rate and amongst the highest rates of illicit drug use. Roughly one in five of people incarcerated in the US is in jail for a drug offence. Mm. One in five, Marion.
I would have thought it was more than that, actually.
It's 20% of your drug population. Therefore,
that's high.
Possession.
You know. But if they don't consider, like, intoxicated murder or, you know, a barge in, you know, a home invasion, you know, for drugs or for profit, if that's not a drug-related drug-related crime, then they won't. Then you've still got your one in five. I think if they looked at the motivation and intoxication as a factor
depends
in committing
on
crime,
definition. Yeah. Criminologists find that other consequences of problematic drug use, such as harm to health, reduced quality of life, and strained personal relationships, are more effective deterrents than criminal sanctions. Because criminalising drugs does not really prevent drug use, decriminalising does not really increase it. Portugal, which decriminalised the personal possession of drugs back in 2001 in response to high illicit drug use, now has much lower rates of drug use than the European average. Use of cocaine amongst young adults aged 15 to 34, for example, is 0.3% in Portugal, compared to 2.1% across the European Union. Amphetamine and MDMA consumption is likewise lower in Portugal.
Two, decriminalisation puts money to better use. Arresting, prosecuting and imprisoning people for drug-related crimes is expensive. The Harvard economist Jeffrey Miron estimates that all government drug prohibition-related expenditures were United States $47.8 billion nationally in 2016. Oregon spent about $375 million on drug prohibition in that year. That's a substantial drop. Oregon will now divert some money previously, although 47.8 was a national figure, I might add. Oregon will now divert some of the money previously used on drug enforcement to pay for about a dozen new drug prevention and treatment centres statewide, which has been found to be a significantly more cost-effective strategy. Some tax revenue from recreational marijuana sales, which exceeded $100 million in 2019, will also go towards addiction and recovery services. Oregon spent about $470 million on substance use treatment between 2017 and 2019. That's in that 2 years. Not everyone who uses drugs needs treatment. Decriminalisation makes help accessible to those who do need it and keeps both users and recreational drug users out of jail.
Well, this has always been the point, hasn't it, Marion? What is the benefit to society of putting people who have developed a problematic relationship with a substance
behind bars where they are more likely to be paying five times the amount for the drugs, because they don't stop using drugs just because they go to jail. They actually use the drugs that are prescribed for other inmates, or they use drugs that are brought in as illicit.
Yeah, contraband.
Or drugs that are brought back from prisoners that go on leave. So it's a real problem, and it's a problem that prison guards are not unmindful of, but they still will not vote for an illicit exchange program.
No, we'll still get that
certainly
issue
not
here.
In the ACT. Yeah, it's a real problem.
It's been a problem for years. Okay, the third point is the drug war targets people of colour. Another aim of decriminalisation is to mitigate the significant racial and ethnic disparities associated with drug enforcement. Illegal drug use is roughly comparable across race in the United States, but people of colour are significantly more likely to be searched, arrested and imprisoned for a drug-related offence. Drug crimes can incur longer prison sentences. Discretion in drug enforcement and sentencing means prohibition is among the leading causes of incarceration of people of colour in the United States, an injustice that many Americans on both sides of the political aisle increasingly recognise. Freed up from policing drug use, police departments may redirect the resources towards crime prevention and solving violent crimes like homicide and robbery.
And what about crimes against women?
What about rape?
Absolutely. That was the first thing I thought of when I looked at that, Jeffrey. Crimes against women in particular, you know, domestic violence or violence, full stop. Mostly violence against women. Women, in particularly in Australia, dying at the rate of what, two a fortnight, one a week.
Yeah. It's a national disgrace.
And absolutely horrendous. And look what's
happening.
And of course,
in Parliament.
We have a culture where violence against women is okay, at coming from the very top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it's about power differential.
Yes.
And also sexism and misogyny and various other...
It's inbuilt and has been inbuilt. I was just almost saying to you before we came back on air after the song, Jeffrey, in Belarus, the guy that's standing for re-election as president is saying that Belarus could not have a woman as president just yet because she wouldn't be able to enforce the laws. I don't know how the hell he came to that conclusion. But the protest movement against this guy is actually headed by a great-grandmother, right, which tells you monumental amounts. It's the women that are marching and saying, you're an idiot.
He's a real dinosaur, that
Belarus. He is. And to come out with a statement like that is just, hang on, honey.
Yeah.
Maybe you should move to Australia, you know, come to Canberra.
Join,
and teach them what sexism oughtn't to look like.
How to do it properly.
Yeah, how to do it properly. Absolutely. And justify it.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Yeah, just this third point about the drug war targeting people of colour. Police departments freed up from policing drug use could direct it to other crimes such as homicide, robbery and crimes against women, as Marion said, which are time-consuming to investigate. That could help restore some trust between law enforcement and the communities of colour in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? That'd be nice here too. I think we could do with that in Australia,
Yes.
Risks of decriminalisation. One common concern among Oregonians who voted against decriminalisation was that lessening criminal penalties would endanger children. Whoop. Quote, I think it sends a really bad message to them and influences their perception of the risks, James O'Rourke, a defence attorney, who helped organise the opposition to Measure 110, told the news site OPB in October. But US states that legalised marijuana haven't seen adolescent use rise significantly. In fact, marijuana consumption among teens, though not amongst college-educated Americans, actually declined in some states with legal marijuana. Now, this is what they found in Amsterdam too, Jeffrey. As I think I've said every time we've talked about this, this may be because legal, regulated marijuana is more difficult for minors to get than black market drugs. Research also shows that for some people, particularly the young, banning a behaviour makes it more alluring. Well, we've known that for years.
Yes,
so defining drugs as a health concern rather than a crime could actually make them less appealing to young Oregonians. Another worry about decriminalisation is that it will attract people looking to use drugs. So-called drug tourism hasn't really been a problem for Portugal, but it happened in Switzerland after officials in the 1980s and 90s began officially ignoring heroin in Zurich Platz Spitz Park. People came from across the country to inject heroin in public, leaving discarded needles on the ground. The local government shut down Platz Spitz Park, but rather than chase off or arrest those who frequented it, it began offering methadone and prescription heroin, and I saw that program, to help people with opioid use disorder. Public injection, HIV rate and overdoses, which had all become a problem in Zurich, plummeted. In fact, people got their park back. The Needle Park became a community park once again, and people were thrilled about it.
Yep.
Certain parts of Oregon already have higher rates of public drug consumption, namely Portland and Eugene, because public drug use is still illegal in Oregon. However, we don't expect a Platz Spitz Park, that's a dreadful thing to say on radio, really, Needle Park type open drug scene to emerge. These places should benefit from the expansion of methadone programs and other medication-assisted treatment, which is endorsed by the American Medical Association. The safe injecting unit is also a case in point, Jeffrey, is that they got to that point where they had a safe injecting centre.
It would be
takes
good.
It straight off the street.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
They wouldn't have had a Needle Park type scene as they did in Zurich. And once they provided heroin, they found that people were happy to come off. And dreadful roundabouts, circles with roundabouts and rings. You know, if you were using heroin, you couldn't get health insurance. If you didn't have health insurance, you couldn't get accommodation. If you didn't have accommodation, you couldn't get a job. If you didn't have a job, you couldn't get accommodation.
Yeah.
It was a really big circle once they brought that program and got rid of all of that. If neighbouring Washington State decriminalises drugs, which it's considering, the chances of drug tourism would drop further.
I noticed there's another discussion going on about banning tourists from the coffee shops in Amsterdam at the moment.
They do that all the time. Yeah, and that just sounds crazy because, I mean, it's the intrigue, you know. The idea of it is just absolutely... It's just an intriguing idea, and to go and have a look at it is just a natural...
Oh, it was fascinating
but
to see
people
it.
Will go and have a look at... They have a look at once, but they spent another 2 weeks in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands.
Doing other stuff. Yeah.
Doing other stuff and spending lots of money, I might add. You try and get accommodation in Amsterdam for anything under, you know...
Yeah, it's a busy city.
500, you know, euros a night. Good luck to you.
It's a beautiful city too.
It's a beautiful city, and it's... Great to go to, and the coffee houses are just like a
small
side
part of
bit
it. Yeah.
of
yeah.
tourism.
Yeah.
People might go to get a particular kind of marijuana from there.
Yeah,
yeah? Like they might go to get hash for a change.
Yeah.
Or a really high brand of Cinsamella, but good quality Cinsamella. But they don't really go there to spend their day just being legless or mindless in a coffee shop.
It's not like they just move into the coffee shop for the duration of their visit.
No, well, they can't sleep there.
No.
But if they do, they go in, get their drugs, have them there, and get coffee and munchies from the shop while they're there. They don't have alcohol sold at the same site, so they can't do that.
No,
they can't combine the two.
No.
So the only alcohol sales are at a different venue altogether, and the Bulldog is a good example of that. And they have a roaring tourist trade, but people don't stay there forever, even though it's in the centre of Amsterdam, or the one of them is anyway.
Interesting to see how that debate goes because, of course, the owners of the coffee shops are appalled at the idea.
Yes, but they don't quote them, Geoffrey. This is what drives me crazy, is that they will do an article like this, but they won't quote their coffee shop managers who are, you know, making a living and just getting a rental from the people who come. They don't actually provide the marijuana. It's other people come and set up shop in the corner of the coffee shop there with their little board, their blackboard with the prices and the amounts and the quality.
It's worked smoothly for years.
Absolutely, and it's just not an issue. And young Dutch boys and girls are growing up, and the major problem, I say this every time we talk about it, is alcohol.
Yeah.
And always has been.
Yep. All right, this piece on Oregon concludes, upside and downside. There are risks with any major policy change. The question is whether the new policy results in a net benefit. In Portugal, full decriminalisation has proven more humane and effective than decriminalisation. Because drug users don't need to worry about facing criminal charges, those who need help are more likely to seek it and get it. Portugal's overdose death rate is 5 times lower than the EU average, which in itself is far lower than the United States. HIV infection rates amongst injecting drug users also dropped massively since 2001. These policies show that problem drug use is a public health challenge to be managed, not a war that can be won.
Good point. And absolutely, you know, that's the bottom
line,
isn't it?
That's the essence of the whole argument.
Stupid idiot.
I mean,
you know, fancy starting a war like that. A war against a drug, Geoffrey. Not like the drug's going to jump up and shoot you from behind. You know, just ludicrous.
Inanimate objects.
Absolutely. How do you have a war on something that can't fight back? It actually becomes a war on the people that consume it, as we say as we say in the title of our
show.
Yes?
Yeah.
The war on people who use drugs.
Okay, the authors of that article were Scott Aikens, professor in the sociology department at Oregon State University, and Clayton Mosher, professor in the sociology department at Washington State University, republished here. That was Black Poppy with permission. I think we'll go to a song, Marion.
Yeah, let's do that.
The original Fleetwood Mac, not the California version. And this is Black Magic Woman, Fleetwood Mac. All right, that was the original Fleetwood Mac and Black Magic Woman.
With
and
the original song, not Santana's at all, as I asked you before.
Written by Peter Green.
Mm, from
the original Fleetwood Mac. British blues band in the 60s. Okay, It's coming up about 20 minutes to noon. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marion. This is 2XX People Powered Radio, 98.3 FM. And I thought we'd do a story about alcohol, as you pointed out many times. And we have it is a drug after all.
It's
not like
indeed.
It's some other thing that's not related to being a drug. It is a drug. This is from the Medical Journal of Australia, and it's saying Australian general practitioners need to better screen their patients for harmful alcohol use. And the subheading is most of the Australian population does not see the need for major changes in regard to alcohol use.
Of course they don't.
And they support support for policies which reduce alcohol-related harms that are based on the strongest evidence is declining, according to the author of this piece. Dr. Chris Holmwood, who is the Director of Clinical Partnerships of Drug and Alcohol Services South Australia, wrote that Australia's National Alcohol Strategy advocates for the adoption of alcohol screening, brief intervention and referral for treatment in primary care. And he's quoted as saying, this is despite a lack of evidence that it is effective in reducing harms, even in research settings, as well as a lack of evidence for its effect on reducing population levels of drinking. And evidence that it does not result in increased engagement in specialist treatment, even in well-resourced health systems. The Alcohol Use Disorder Identification Test, or AUDIT, was originally developed by the World Health Organization to assist with widespread standardized implementation of screening and brief intervention programs with the aim of reducing subsequent drinking and associated harms. More recently, the Alcohol Smoking and Substance Involvement Screening Test, or ASSIST, was developed to address a broad range of substances. The AUDIT and the ASSIST both explore relevant key areas such as frequency of use, harms and dependence, which are important for the clinician and the patient to understand and address, Dr. Holmwood wrote. They enable the clinician and the patient to determine the risks associated with the patient's current drinking patterns and to commence a conversation, which then enables an agreed response. They should still be promoted as tools to use when a patient has been identified as drinking excessively through normal clinical processes. However, the expectation that they will have a substantial effect on population-level drinking patterns is not backed by the evidence. So people get told you're drinking too much.
And they say, tough.
Well, yeah, no, I'm not.
So tell me something else. Tell me something I don't know. I think people generally know when they're drinking too much, but they're up to a point where they don't care.
And culturally, there's not much of a sort of... Most people, like you said, they don't actually have the awareness of what the recommended levels
are. No, and they don't care because if they can't see themselves, you know, if you can't see yourself in the image of the advertisements, if you like, particularly against harmful drinking, if you're not reflected in that, then you're not going to see the message as being valid for you. That's why people, same with recreational drug users, don't see themselves reflected as in the junkie mould, or ice users will still talk about heroin users as the junkies.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to rationalise. Oh, this doesn't apply to me.
No, this is not me. Yeah. I don't look like that. I don't beat my wife. Not that I remember anyway. Yeah, but how come she had a black eye? Well... Anyway, the article goes on, when faced with a person whose alcohol use is becoming problematic, Dr. Holmwood identified that the general practice environment in Australia, quote, does not support general practitioners responding to the problem. This has got to be one of the dead set, like, talk about the most obvious statement. Longer consultations are insufficiently remunerated, skills development has been suboptimal, and secondary and tertiary services are not readily available when and where required. Dr. Holmwood said that there should be a, quote, renewed emphasis on alcohol as a significant driver of morbidity and mortality at three levels. One, on the clinical level, renewed emphasis on education and training for medical practitioners to enable clinicians to better respond to people drinking harmfully. Two, on the healthcare structural level, changing remuneration arrangements to better support primary care treatment for people with alcohol-related problems should be advocated for. And three, in parallel with these changes, increased advocacy for changes to policies that reduce drinking and related harms on a population level, with particular emphasis on high-risk populations. Now, I remember a good friend of mine, Tim, who had the most horrendous abdominal blood and mucus combination, you know, big pot belly, Jeffrey, and he used to pretend he didn't drink but would always, every day, bought at least one cask of this gross white wine, so-called white wine. Oh, it was okay. like Fruity Lexia, it was called. It was just bloody horrible anyway. But he used to walk through, he'd wash his sheets every morning, always had a set of sheets in the washing machine, walk through the kitchen, pour himself a glass of wine, chuck it down and back out to the washing machine to do the washing, come back from the washing into the kitchen, get himself another glass of wine, chuck it down and come back to sit down with us in the living room and not drink.
Yeah.
Right, so he was kidding himself and us, he thought, that he wasn't drinking, but he was going through at least a cask of wine a day.
Plenty of people doing that.
And he ended up dying, just bled out in the middle of the night. He used to go into Kurt's room and say, can I sleep with you because my room's a mess? And it was because he'd just been bleeding from the bowel every morning. It was very sad. Anyway, and he kept going to the doctor and the doctor couldn't. He wouldn't tell the doctor the truth. So
how can you offer advice?
And then he didn't tell us the truth either, but he just died. He was just yellow when he died. His liver just killed him. Australia remains, this is Dr. Homewood goes on, opportunities for the development of advocacy schools at medical, student and postgraduate levels should be developed and promoted, Dr. Homewood wrote. Australia remains a world leader in tobacco control. The health profession, this is arguable. The health profession should join forces, building on the lessons from tobacco control, which is, you know, abstinence-based, Jeffrey, which we
But at least we
not
help,
been.
Help people with
Well,
next
yeah,
time
helping is the important thing, and that's the thing I think we need to focus on. To change the way the Australian community views alcohol, which will take a huge community shift, and then lead changes in clinical practice and policy, which will reduce alcohol-related harms, Dr. Homer concluded. That sounds really easy, but it's a really hard thing to do with an ingrained culture like ours, which was built on a rum rebellion, if you like, and, you know, rum-encrusted criminals and sailors coming out to Australia. And has, you know, I mean, people were paid in rum in the early
days. It's part of Australian culture.
It is, and it's so heftily part of our culture.
Yeah. And so changing it is
but
a big
it doesn't ask. Mean it can't change.
No.
It just means there
or
has
should.
To be a reason for it.
Yeah.
People need to see that by changing their behaviour, they will improve their lives and the lives of those people that they love and that love them.
Yeah.
But these days we don't see that.
No, there's not enough effort being made.
Look at the women that are complaining about the assaults that they've been undergoing when they've been intoxicated.
Yeah.
That's what happens, you know, that's why we have sex, is because we're intoxicated. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a huge problem.
It is a huge problem.
We said you and I were going to play a Hendrix track.
Yes, let's do that before
this is
we go.
Hendrix and Red House, Jimi Hendrix. The late, great Jimi Hendrix and Red House. Okay, we're coming to the end of this week's program. Perhaps you could just remind people who may be interested in doing a Loxone workshop, that there
and
is one on today.
With a jube in her mouth. Today's workshop, it's 2 to 3pm at the Early Morning Centre in the city. If you ring 62475041, that's the Early Morning Centre's number, you can book a place in today's opioid overdose recognition and response with Naloxone workshop. If you want to do this workshop at any other time or at an upcoming date, ring Dave on 6253-3643, but not this afternoon. Dave or Damo would be able to tell you about it at the Kahama Centre. But this afternoon's workshop from 2 till 3.30 is at the Early Morning Centre, and just call on 6247-5041. Everybody's doing the COVID vaccine time frames and roll out, so we're not going to do that too, although we did have an article on that to discuss, but we've spent our time discussing much more pressing issues that no one else is discussing. So,
well, I think the COVID vaccination stuff,
I think it's been covered
everywhere.
By people left, right and centre, but this is, you know, this is what we do. COVID is something that we certainly took the place of a face-to-face service delivery during the COVID lockdown, which was a great relief, I think, for you and me and perhaps many other people too. We had some good feedback on that.
Community radio can be.
Absolutely. It's how essential having a voice to the community, a direct voice to the community is. And we were certainly grateful for that opportunity. It was very pleasing to be needed. And for the need for the show to actually be highlighted by the lockdown, if you like.
Indeed.
We were pleased, weren't we?
Indeed.
So anyway, we'll just say take care, look after each other, be kind to yourselves and to other people, and they'll probably be kind back to you. And we'll see you next week.
I think a bit of kindness and compassion
would go a long way.
A hell of a long way. And look, if you need to talk to somebody about
please do, about
use,
anything, about substance use, about violence, about rape, about just please do reach out. Don't be sad by yourself. Somebody else can help you to be sad, but they can also lift your mood.
Yeah.
That once you say how you feel, it becomes real.
Yeah.
Please do that. Talk to someone if you need it.
Because it can be hard to reach out for help.
It's extremely difficult. There are many men out there I know who don't talk to people about things they need to talk about, like being afraid, like being worried, like being nervous and being anxious, because they see it as unmanly.
And a weakness.
And they can't afford to be weak. But I tell you, women are happy to be spoken to about that kind of sensitive issue because it makes men more human to them.
Yeah. I'm wondering how the impact of especially the period of lockdown, like in countries like the UK, what mental health impact that must be huge.
Well, that I've noticed on ABC News yesterday or last night, they certainly said that the overdose rates had gone up in Australia during the lockdown period, and particularly because we had such a long lockdown period in Victoria last year that they had substantial increase, particularly among teenagers and school-aged students and tertiary students. They just didn't handle the absence from their community, and their relationships suffered because they couldn't see each other and they just were desperate.
And at that age, it's really important.
Well, you don't want to talk to your mum and dad about stuff, but you want to talk
with
to your friends.
Yeah.
But, it's a double-edged sword, wasn't it?
You know,
bullying and stuff goes the same way.
All right, we will leave you, as usual, with the theme song for our show.
Jeffrey knows exactly what time to put this on, so.
Here's Golden Brown by the Strangers.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.